Hello and welcome to our bonus call for the Clinical Mastery of the Digestive System program. This is a bonus call on the impact of lectins on gut health. And I remember when this came about and why this came about as part of the program is in the early stages, I think in the pre-class stuff, we were talking about lectins and a lot of questions came up and it's been in the press a lot. And so I said I was going to throw in a bonus call on lectins. So here we are. Lectins are another food constituent. We'll get into what those are exactly. But there's a lot of those evil foods constituents that may be problematic for certain people, but also have some great benefit and may or may not be bad, quote unquote, for everyone. So we're going to go through in this presentation what exactly lectins are and what the dark side of lectins are, what the bright side of lectins are. And then we're going to end with a therapeutic protocol. It's basically how do you determine for each person whether lectins are an issue, and if so, how do you therapeutically proceed to eliminate and check. So let's go through a little bit about that. But before I do, I just want to make sure that you're aware that everything I'm talking about isn't intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare practitioner, especially if you're thinking about this for your own self or for your own, you know, family members, your clients. And it's just intended as education from my research and my clinical experience. So whatever you do or whatever you advise your clients to do, make sure that if they're under the care of a physician or another health practitioner, that they check in with that practitioner to make sure that what they're doing is not going to interfere with the protocols. So let's start off with, first of all, what are lectins? All of you have heard of lectins. You can't not hear of lectins. Even the lay population has heard of lectins. Years ago, I'm not talking a lot of years ago, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, it was only us in the healing professions, only us in the functional medicine arena that were really talking about all these different food constituents that have now become just language around the dinner table in most households of fairly educated or somewhat educated people on the aspect of health. And the reason is because of the internet. Because of Facebook, because of summits, and there's so much education out there, and people are learning about lectins, about oxalates and sulfur compounds and histamines and all the other food constituents that are supposed to be anti-nutrients. And guess what? In my opinion, this is my observation, is it gets people freaked out. There are people who have become food phobic and they don't know what to eat because they heard someone speak about lectins and another doctor speak about histamines and another about oxalates and another about high sulfur foods and another about different other kinds of amines. And they're just trying to avoid all this food because it's been presented to them by these so-called experts as being bad food. Unhealthy. So just like they're avoiding sugar and flour and hydrogenated oils, they're avoiding these foods that contain these constituents. Unfortunately, all the foods out there contain a little bit of each of these things. So if we try to avoid all these so-called harmful constituents, anti-nutrients in our foods, we would be left with, guess what? A glass of water. And even at that, no one will agree on what kind of water that is. Reverse osmosis, Kangen water, alkaline water, distilled water, spring water. So it's just, it puts people in a state of confusion. And my purpose with this presentation today is to take, help you pull out of that confusion and be able to make sense with the person that's in front of you that's asking for help with specific health challenges. So let's talk about what lectins are. They are actually a type of sugar-binding protein. They're a protein that binds to sugar, especially in cell membranes, and it can make things stick together. But the thing about lectins and other of these anti-nutrients in foods, they're a protective mechanism developed by the species of plants to prevent it from being over-harvested by the animals. Animals, unlike humans, because we've had our taste buds so thwarted by crazy stuff that we call food, the animals will eat a little bit of one food and then they sense that that's enough, and they go to another plant, and they go to another plant, and they go to another plant. And what they're detecting are these anti-nutrients. They're detecting the lectins or the oxalates or other things in the foods, and they make the decision of having a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Humans, on the other hand, have had their taste buds thwarted from the time they were born for many people, when they're fed infant formula loaded with high fructose corn syrup and God knows what else that shouldn't belong in the human baby's body. And by the time you hit your first birthday, you're served chocolate cake and you're getting teething biscuits at 6 months old to try to help with those teeth coming in. Those are loaded with sugar and flour and gluten and lots of lectins. And we lose the ability to discern good food from bad food, eating too much of a certain food because we get a buildup of the toxic residues. The truth of the matter is every single food out there, I cannot think of a single one, has some sort of chemicals like this that in excess are going to be harmful for the human body. The trick is that figuring out what that in excess is for each person. And depending on the state, and we'll talk about who's susceptible and who's not, depending on that state of the individual, a little bit might be too much for that person versus someone else can tolerate a whole lot more. So it's a way that the plants are protecting themselves from these animals and predators from eating too much of them. But also it's a way for the seeds to get dispersed because the lectins actually coat the seeds. It's a coating on the seeds of these particular plants, and it makes it so that they don't get easily broken down. Now, there are situations and things we can do to them to help break them down, but just taking and swallowing a whole seed is just going to go through you. And I'm sure you've had that experience either with yourself or your kids or someone where you see sunflower seeds pop out in the toilet on the other end, right? Our bodies can't break them down unless we chew them, we soak them, we germinate them, we cook them, whatever. So it's a way for propagation of the species. And they are resistant to human digestion, and some of these lectins, these particles, can actually make their way into the digestive tract when the gut is hyperpermeable. So if the gut is hyperpermeable, we can get the entrance of lectins into the gut, but the lectins in excess for that person can actually aggravate and be one of the factors that contributes to leaky gut, right? So in many cases, when people have developed this sensitivity and developed a leaky gut, we do need to get them off the particular constituents or lower their levels so that they don't continue to assault the digestive tract and make the situation worse. Once they enter into the bloodstream, just like undigested food particles, just like undigested gluten proteins or dairy proteins or broccoli proteins, when in the bloodstream, the body mounts an immune response. And this can lead to the production of antibodies. Some of those antibodies can then cross-react with human tissue and become autoantibodies. So this is the story behind what lectins are, what they do in the body. This is a picture just to show it there on the cell wall, and it's along with other markers on the cell wall. It's just a little thing that sticks out, and it protects. These are pictures of some of the lectins that have been identified. It's just there to show you, not intended for you to memorize or remember. I know this one called Rican is actually from castor oil, and castor bean oil is a tough one. And the one, I can't read them, they're so small. But anyway, there's just to give you an idea of the different shapes, the different molecular structures of some of the more common lectins that are in our food supply. So where are they found? Well, all foods contain them, not just certain foods. They're especially high in raw legumes and raw grains. Now, fortunately, most people don't eat raw legumes, although some people do try sprouting, like lentils and garbanzo beans and things like that. So those may have to be careful. The highest concentration is actually in kidney beans. So you've never seen nobody sprouts kidney beans and eats them or tries to eat them raw. They get pretty sick pretty quickly because the levels are so high in the raw kidney beans. So some of these are broken down. We'll talk about what kind of preparation methods can help break it down. They're hardest to break down in the legumes, which may be why a lot of people do have difficulties in digesting legumes. A lot of people want to blame it on the sugars in there not being broken down, but I think it's a combination of that with the lectins. The part of the seed that becomes the leaves is where the lectins live. So that's the coat, as well as on the coat. They're also found in dairy products, especially dairy products from cows that have been fed grain and other, you know, non-natural things for cows. Certain vegetables, those are very low in vegetables, mostly, most notably in the nightshades and in the seeds and skins of things like cucumbers and squashes. And then the levels of them in the levels of the lectins that we can tolerate have to do with some of the genetic alterations. And I'm going to share with you a chart of some of those genes that would predispose someone to having an issue with lectins. So how do lectins impact the human body? Well, this one phytohemagglutinin, it's a hard word to say, is in raw sprouted kidney beans. There's 20,000 to 70,000 lectin units in those raw sprouted kidney beans. And I say sprouted, it's in the raw beans, but nobody would eat them raw. They may try to eat them sprouted, although most people don't. But when they've fully cooked, it drops down to 20 to 40,000. So that's a tenfold decrease in the amount. Lectins, like other things, like oxalates and histamines, are generally dose dependent. Unlike things to which someone may have developed a true antibody reaction with the immune system, or just a little bit of an antigen can trigger a response. With things like oxalates and lectins and histamines and some of the other food constituents, it's dose dependent. And how much is a bad dose for what each individual person has a lot to do with some factors we'll talk about in a bit. When people consume large amounts, if someone who just goes in there and starts to eat raw kidney beans or sprout them or not cook them quite long enough, we can actually get reactions. And people might think that they're having a food poisoning reaction because they could get diarrhea and nausea and vomiting and things like that. But it also increases the leaky gut every time they're consumed in a quantity larger than the body can tolerate. It can be inflammatory and can trigger the formation of antibodies, which can aggravate inflammatory conditions and autoimmune, which is why you'll hear some folks talking about, you know, lectins, get off of lectins, it's the cure for all diseases. Well, it can be a helpful thing in situations where people have inflammation that's triggered by lectins. And how do we find this out? We'll talk about this in our therapeutic approach at the end, but it's the same way we figure all these things out. A careful study, careful questioning, and an elimination diet, and then provocation. That's how we determine it. We don't tell somebody, oh, you're lectin sensitive, you gotta get off lectins for the rest of your life, and here, take this supplement to make up for it. That's not good healthcare. So let's move to looking a little bit more closely about the downside of lectins and what they can do. We talked about how they affect the gut. They can create holes in the gut lining, leading to hyperpermeability, aka leaky gut. That can also contribute to dysbiosis because we've got an imbalance in the gut because of the leakiness, the inflammation, and that can aggravate a dysbiosis situation. In the bloodstream, when they get in there, they do have an affinity for leptin and insulin receptors, and leptin versus lectin. So lectin can bind to leptin receptors. So what happens when there's an abundance, an overabundance of lectins getting into the bloodstream, right, which implies eating a bunch and having a leaky gut, so they escape into the bloodstream. What happens is they can bind onto the insulin or leptin receptors and create a situation called leptin or insulin resistance. And we know that those are very, very common. It desensitizes those receptors. And it's considered no surprise by researchers that the top allergens, gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, peanuts, and tree nuts, also have significant sources of lectins. Huh, maybe that reaction that people are having isn't just an allergic reaction, it might be a lectin reaction. They've been shown to contribute to urinary tract infections. They've also been shown to be linked with anemia. So they what they do is they call this cause clumping of cells and clumping of molecules. And this can create problems with the absorption of specific minerals. It can create problems with specific chemicals and proteins in the body and the way they're supposed to work. So there's some downsides. There's also a response in the gut. So they can be irritating to the endothelium. In fact, they would be. But here's the thing. If we're eating, you know, modest amounts of lectins, we're not overdoing on the lectins, and we have a decent intact gut response. We've worked through our clinical mastery of the digestive system on ourselves and on our clients. Then it's unlikely that it's going to create that irritation except in the people that are most sensitive. It can also increase the permeability and lead to or exacerbate leaky gut and lead to dysbiosis. So that's how it's affecting the gut itself. But there has to be a predisposition, right? There's usually going to be a predisposition that causes this person to be overly sensitive. It could be an excessive consumption, or it could be just that they have the genetics there, or they have a prior condition of leaky gut from, well, say a gluten intolerance, although the gluten intolerance may indeed be partially problematic because of the lectins. It could be a combination of the two. Right? They could be eating the standard American diet and drinking the standard American diet beverages and creating inflammation and thinning the mucosa of their lining of the digestive tract through excess caffeine and alcohol and sugar and processed foods and hydrogenated fats that create and help loss, create a loss of the intestinal bacteria, I mean intestinal lining integrity. So here's a chart. I put this together. I gave you a full-size copy of this. If you look on the side, you should be able to download it. And it's basically columns of foods and the ones that are high and the ones that are lower. So if we look at the nuts and seeds, we see that the ones that are highest are almonds, cashews, pine nuts, chia seeds, and pumpkin seeds. Now, when we germinate those seeds, they become significantly lower. So these are, we're talking about just straight out of the box, almonds or almond butter straight out of the jar, those sorts of things. But if we're soaking and germinating chia seeds, that can be very helpful and soothing to the gut. Again, you've got to be tuning in to how that person is reacting. Sometimes people have a problem with chia seeds bloating them because of a lectin problem, but also it could be a FODMAP problem because they're high in those FODMAP carbohydrates. So on the other side, where the lower lectin nuts and seeds are coconut, chestnut, macadamia nut, pecans, pistachios, walnuts, flax seeds, hemp seeds, sesame seeds. Now, all of them are going to be significantly lower when we germinate them. So another reason for having people soak and rinse their nuts and seeds before they use them. It makes them much more digestible in terms of starting the process of breaking down the carbohydrates, protein, and fats, but also because it reduces the lectin content. So on the fruits and veggie side, and I've seen cucumbers on both sides of the fence here. Cucumbers, if you eat them whole with the skin and the seeds intact, are considered high in lectins. If you peel them, which most people do, and then remove the seeds, which most people don't, then they become low lectin. So you can monitor the foods and you can change the way the food is prepared to decrease the lectin content. So we have cucumbers, eggplant, peppers, pumpkin, squash, and tomatoes. And most of this is the nightshades. And if you look at them, most of them have seeds, right? And the seeds are what tend to have the highest concentration of lectins. So any of those foods, if you eat them without the seeds, are going to reduce the lectin concentration for people who are sensitive. So rather than creating this very restrictive diet where you're taking out all these things to see if they're sensitive to lectins, you're actually going to be able to play with the dosing and play with the way, the preparation of them in terms of finding what they can eat. Because our goal is always not to reduce the numbers of foods people can eat, but we want to increase the numbers of foods people eat. And back in the day, when I first started doing this 25 years ago or more, people were not on restricted diets. You had to talk to them about doing elimination diets. These days, people have heard so much. A lot of folks are coming in to see you and say, I have five foods I can eat and that's it. So we want to help them expand their repertoire rather than shrink it. But sometimes at the beginning, we have to have them shrink it and then do a really careful provocation to figure out what works for them. When we look at the legumes, all of the legumes pretty much are high in lectins, so including cacao. So those of you who have a problem with eating cacao, it possibly could be lectins. But there's a whole bunch of other chemical constituents in each of these foods that could contribute to an intolerance. And sometimes we're not going to figure out exactly, you know, the nuts and bolts and the exact chemicals that the person is reacting to. What we might be doing is helping them to figure out just which foods they tolerate and in what quantities. So for the, you know, cacao, chickpeas, kidney beans, lentils, mung beans, what's that say? I can't read it. Peanuts, soy, all of these nuts are high in lectins, all of these legumes are high in lectins. Don't tell people to soak and germinate and sprout their legumes in order to make them lower in lectins, because you actually can increase the amount of that they can eat, and eating it raw doesn't change it at all. So sprouting doesn't change the number of lectins at all in the legumes. It does in the nuts and seeds. So it's really important that the legumes, if consumed, are consumed well-cooked and finding the quantity that works for them. And the best way is actually to germinate them first and then go ahead and cook them. So with lentils, you can go ahead and soak them and sprout them and get a little tail and then cook them. They cook faster that way and you get the benefits of germinating and making the nutrients more bioavailable and then also reducing the lectin content. So it's a matter of finding the dose. It's said somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% or even up to 90% of a reduction in the lectin content of a particular legume. And then we have grains. So the ones that are the worst are the gluten grains, the wheat, the barley, the rye, the kamut, the spelt. The oats and rice are also up there. The ones that are lower tend to be amaranth, wild rice, quinoa, and millet, more of the non-gluten grains. Although we can all talk about the finer points of gluten and argue that all of these grains have a particular type of gluten, just not the gliadin and some of the more major ones that I think they're called the prolamines, better in the gluten-containing ones that we know of and we think about, right? So again, you know, sprouting them and then cooking them tends to make them much more bioavailable. And on the animal foods, it's really the difference between grain-fed and grass-fed. Grass-fed is going to be lower in lectins, the dairy and the meats themselves. And then finally, sweeteners. There are some sweeteners that are high in lectins. Agave, the artificial sweeteners, sugar, sucrose, and sucralose. The low glycemic sweeteners that we tend to talk more about tend to be lower in lectins, so that's good to know. Monk fruit, lohan, Jerusalem artichoke, which can be found in either a dehydrated powder or a syrup, stevia, xylitol, erythritol, and yacon. So all of those are the lower. So this is a chart. I made this chart for you, especially for you. Made it look pretty, and you can print it out and have it handy. So when you're working with someone and you suspect that they might be lectin intolerant, that you can experiment with it. So here's the thing. It's a double-edged sword, right? There's foods have all these great nutrients, and they have some, small amounts generally, anti-nutrients. So there are things that have been found to be health promoting. Lectins can decrease the incidence of certain diseases. And I'll share with you some of the research on cancer. There's some cancers that have been found to be reduced by lectins. And then lectins are used for cell-to-cell adherence. So it helps to modulate inflammation and modulate cell-programmed cell death. So these are things that are important. So we don't want to, the saying goes, throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? You don't want to say don't eat these foods because they have lectins in them. Well, as we said, all foods do have lectins in them. They all have them. It's just a matter of degree and quantity and how sensitive the person is. So variety is actually the spice of life. I'm throwing out all these cliches, huh? So here's some of the stuff with cancer. Mushrooms, not just your medicinal mushrooms like reishi and cordyceps and the others like that, chaga and all, but also just your ordinary mushrooms, your ordinary culinary mushrooms. They actually contain a lectin that inhibits the proliferation of cancer cells in vitro. And by the way, I have 3 pages of references in the back of your slides. So if you want to go deeper and, you know, find out more about these studies, you can. There's also been some lectins found, and they're being investigated right now for their cancer therapeutics in fava beans, soybeans, bananas, buckwheat, jackfruit, and wheat. And there's a study on each of these in your references at the back. And then there's some plant food lectins that actually block the angiogenesis promoting lectins that are on the human cells. So even humans have lectins on our tissues, right? They're markers. They're just markers. So angiogenesis is that creation of a new blood supply that allows a cancer to grow and grow out of control. And so these lectins, some of the lectins in the plant foods can actually disrupt that angiogenesis. So early research, but like everything, there's a double-edged sword, right? So we want to be able to talk sensibly to people so we don't create this horrific fear in their life where they're like scared to death to eat anything anymore. So how do you decrease the lectin activity? Well, it's dose control. So first of all, right, if you're sitting down to a meal or your client is sitting down to a meal and their typical meal is 75% of their plate, say they're vegan, they're on a plant-based diet, they eat 75% of their plate is generally going to be beans and grain. And then this 25% is going to be vegetables. So when you go the other direction, which is my plate is a 75% vegetable plate. And then the 25% is whatever the person chooses for their more concentrated, dense food. It might be some organic grass-fed meat. It might be some nuts or seeds or a nice nut and seed pate. It might be some legumes and grains or one or the other. It could be anything, whatever that is. But the 75-25 is what I propose, is that 75% of the plate be those like abundantly rich, phytochemical-rich vegetables. And then the other 25%. So if you're eating that way, it's much different. The load of lectins that a person's getting, even if they're sensitive, is going to be way less than the person who eats the typical plant-based meal. I know about you, but if I go out to a restaurant and I order a meal and I generally don't order greens and beans. I just want salads and nuts and seeds and avocados and plant-based fats. But I'll watch what people get, and it's like, it's just this huge inordinate amount of grains and beans, which could be problematic. When we look at diets like paleo diet or keto diet, which takes out the grains completely, a lot of people thrive on those. And could it be the lectins? Sure. Could it be other constituents in there? Sure. You know, we just have to see what is going on and not just freak out and say, you know, we got to take these foods out of the diet. And there's a lot of folks out there that are doing that and scaring the life out of people. So it's dose control. Sprouting, except like I said, with the legumes, we don't want to sprout the legumes and then eat them. And with the grains, it's better to sprout them and then cook them and then eat them. So same with legumes, sprout them, cook them and eat them, because when you eat them raw, you have a high level of lectins and there's other things that they can be uncomfortable for somebody with sensitivity. Fermenting works beautifully. Fermented vegetables, fermented grains, fermented, you make a kefir grains from nuts and seeds. There's so many things you can do with fermentation, and that enhances the health effects of these things and decreases the anti-nutrient effects dramatically. Soaking and cooking, when you say beans, legumes, if you just take legumes out of the dried legumes and just cook them, most people get gas from it because it's hard to break them down. But when you soak them and change the soak water several times and even add baking soda to the soak water, that can be really helpful. Some people even propose adding a little bit of apple cider vinegar when you're soaking and germinating nuts and seeds to help break down some of those lectins in there. And then sea vegetables will definitely disable them. So all the right cooking methods allow people to not have to restrict their diet so much if they do happen to be lectin sensitive. Now, for a time, they may need to go off all of these foods and they may need to really seriously curtail the amount that they eat. But that would be a temporary solution, not a long-term solution. So the plant paradox. I'm sure you've heard of the book. You've heard Gundry on Facebook, and you've seen these posts that are so dramatic, and just watch this. And he goes on and on and on about these evil foods that everybody should avoid. And he ends with, and then if you avoid all these foods, you're going to be deficient in nutrients, so buy my supplement. And I think I'm being a little bit, I'm probably being a little bit tongue in cheek here, but that's kind of what it comes out to be. And he makes it like, this is it, and everybody should stop eating all the great foods, the nutritious foods, because they're loaded with lectins, and lectin is the cause of all disease. Whenever anybody says that any particular food constituent is the cause or cure of all disease, my antennas go up, my red flags get raised. I think there's so much biochemical individuality that we have to look at each person. And yes, some people get dramatic results. Some people reverse their autoimmune diseases when they go off of lectins. But is it just the lectins that's causing it when you look at it? They're going off of gluten. They're going off of inflammatory foods. There's a lot to it. So if we look at what the forbidden foods are, well, refined and starchy foods, absolutely. We don't want people eating refined foods. And he eliminates potatoes and pastries and cookies, and that's all good. Sugar, agave, maple syrup, aspartame, and most other artificial sweeteners, that's good. But then it's all peas, beans, squash, tomatoes, melon, zucchini, peppers, goji berries, and lentils. That's a lot of good foods, right? And does everybody need to get off a squash if they have a lectin sensitivity? Is that really an issue? Well, it happens to be seeds, so you try it that way first. So putting somebody on this severely restricted diet, number one, makes them just crazy. They don't want to do it, but also leaves them with very little to eat and can lead to nutrient imbalances. You know, it says, okay, all the soy stuff, so soy tofu, sure, I don't eat soy. I'll eat soy sauce or something like that occasionally. Cow's milk products, all that, that's fine. There's a lot of other reasons for that. Pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, chia seeds, peanuts, cashews. So all the nuts that he's taken away, does it have to be taken away? Maybe, maybe not. But it's all going to be for that time of experimentation as part of the what? The elimination diet. And then oils, I'm not a big fan of oils anyway, so that's not a problem. And then taking away all the whole grains, most of them are gluten-containing. And yes, yeah, some people do much better. And it may not be the lectins. It could be the lectins, but you have to look at the other constituents in there. It could be a disaccharide imbalance that they can't break down the sugars, the saccharide imbalance. So there's a lot of reasons for this. But we have to just take caution when we're starting to take huge quantities of foods across the map away from people and telling them this is the way you have to eat for the rest of your life. I believe, yeah, we can put people on elimination diets. You can get them down to 5 to 10 foods that they eat for a couple of weeks just to let everything calm down and then reintroduce. But you've always got to have that plan in mind to reintroduce, in my opinion. So yeah, there's some people who think this guy walks on water and they believe everything he says. There's other people who are extreme skeptics and think he's a total quack. You know, I think there's something in the middle. There's definitely science to lectins causing health issues. But is it a universal problem that everybody who has a particular disease or everybody in the world gets to go on this diet because of the lectins? I don't think so. I think it's a scare tactic. And I think there's a lot of really good marketing behind this too. So I'm being a skeptic here. So let's talk about who's at risk. Like what are some of the risk factors for lectin sensitivity? Well, someone who has inflammatory bowel disease, but they have to be careful about everything they eat. They can't eat stuff that they can't even eat raw vegetables for a while of any kind, whether they're lectin containing or not, because the lining is so inflamed and irritated. We put them on juices or we put them on steamed and blended green soups to try to heal it, broths, elixirs, things that are not fibrous. Inflammatory bowel disease is a contraindication for just about everything while you're in the healing phase, except for fresh whole, you know, juices and things like that. Leaky gut. If somebody already has leaky gut and they eat a high lectin diet, they're likely to develop some sensitivities to it. They already have an autoimmune disease, means they probably already have or have had a leaky gut, in which case they're going to be much more prone to these lectins aggravating it even more, but more so getting into the bloodstream and causing a more systemic problem. Elevated levels of adiponectin, if you may recall that from our hormones module in CMDS, we talked about adiponectin and its relationship to appetite and leptins and all this. And when that's elevated, it's found to be a risk factor for people who are lectin sensitive. It's not something that's measured a lot, though, but I just thought I'd throw it in there. Those with low dopamine and serotonin symptoms, so people with anxiety, depression, low motivation, OCD, when they already have low levels of serotonin and dopamine, it's been found that lectin sensitivity can aggravate that, and that the lectins can actually, get into the gut-brain connection, affect the brain, and affect the levels of serotonin and dopamine. And also, dopamine and serotonin are abundant in the GI tract, so that can be a problem. So somebody already has some of those symptoms, you may be looking at do lectin-containing foods aggravate them. And then there's genetic markers. There's certain specific genetics that will predispose someone to being more prone to lectin intolerance. And here's some of the SNPs. So there's one, this is actually quite interesting, the cannabinoid receptor. The cannabinoid, we talked about, you guys weren't on that call, that was an NEPT call, but we had a specialist talking to us about the cannabis and the medical uses of cannabis and the cannabinoid receptors. Well, the gene for the cannabinoid receptor, having a T in that gene, in that SNP, will actually cause somebody to be more susceptible to leptins. The MTHFR, both C677T and 1298C, predispose somebody to be more sensitive to lectins. And then there's something called the major histocompatibility complex, MHC, and there's four RSIDs associated with that. So this is stuff that you can look at somebody's 23andMe report and see if they have a higher than usual risk for genetics of predisposing to lectin sensitivity. So let's look at a therapeutic approach to this. And the therapeutic approach is not unlike what I've already taught you. It's just, you start by asking lots of questions. We really want to get to the heart of the symptoms that they're having and what are the provoking and alleviating factors to those symptoms. When did this stuff first start? What was happening in their life right before all these symptoms started to come about that could be instigating this situation? That's going to help you to determine which of the foods that they're eating, consuming, can be aggravating factors. And then you can design for them an elimination diet. You want to get a really detailed food and symptom diary. Have them write it down, or if they won't do that, at least do some dietary recalls. Tell me about your symptoms. Tell me when you last had no symptoms or were asymptomatic. When was your last flare? And tell me about what you were eating at that time. Better if you can get them to take the diaries because it makes so much sense, because they don't necessarily know how to read it, but you can play detective in reading it and determine which food or food constituents might be problematic. If they start to tell you that every time they eat beans or grains, they eat certain seeds, that they feel bad, they eat nightshades, it's possibly a clue that there's some lectin sensitivity there. So that detailed health history is also important. What medications are they on? What supplements are they on? What kind of factors might be contributing to the symptoms that they're having? And then design a food elimination diet. Like I said, sometimes I'll get people down to four foods. Sometimes they're willing to do like a juice or a water fast, in which case that can jumpstart and help the reintroduction of these foods much better. We want to go through our typical leaky gut protocol, the four R's, restore, remove, restore, replace, and reinoculate. And we want to go through that same way we taught you in the CMDS. This is no different. In order to get over any of these food sensitivities, they have to have an intact gut. Otherwise, all those food constituents are going to keep leaking into the bloodstream. They're not intended to be in the bloodstream. They're intended to go through and get pooped away. So that's what we want to get them to, so that everything's staying in the digestive tract that should, and the stuff that shouldn't gets, and the stuff that should get into the bloodstream, like the nutrients, gets in there. You want your reintroduction to be really well planned. You're going to be taking away some foods. You're going to have them journal. Then you're going to have them add things back one at a time, a small number at a time, 2 to 3 at a time, small amounts, so that you can discern what's actually going on with them. Sometimes if you add too many foods back at the same time, they don't know. So for somebody who's super sensitive, I do one food at a time. Now that can be laborious and tedious and take a long time. So you can group a few foods together, but watch the quantity as well. It was through a food elimination and then provocation that I determined that I had sensitivity to eggs and got a horrific headache, which I didn't associate when I was in my day-to-day life because it was, the headaches were sporadic, my egg eating was sporadic. But when I started to do the elimination, I realized that it had to do with the quantity of egg I had, not just the having of the egg. Quantity and frequency as well. So carefully monitoring, being with them, taking care of what is going on with them and helping them to determine it, what the problems are so that they can create a diet that's sustainable. A diet of four or five foods is not sustainable. We spoke to someone on one of the calls yesterday and she had talked about how she was down to like three foods. She was eating zucchini and avocado and carrots or something like that. I don't remember the exact foods, but she did that for over a course of a month. And she got everything healed, and then she started adding things back in, and she's doing much better. So sometimes that's what it takes, is to get them down to the bare-bone basics and keep going. And when you're doing that, you really want to identify some supplements or concentrated things like juices and stuff to get the nutrients in while you're eliminating a lot of these foods. And I have references. So I have three pages of references. Some of them are scientific studies. Some of them are articles that have compilations of scientific studies. But there's a lot of references out there. If you do want to go deeper and understand this more, you can. But the bottom line really is that lectin sensitivity is real. Lectins are a double-edged sword. They have some good properties. They have some negative properties. The negative properties have to do with excess for that individual person. So you can't say that, well, you can eat 3 cups of lectin-containing foods and that's it. Some people might be able to eat 3 tablespoons. Some people may be able to eat unlimited quantities. It just depends on their gut, depends on their genetics, it depends on their overall state of health, what's going to be there. But I just really caution you not to jump on bandwagons of getting everybody off of histamines or getting everybody off of lectins and getting everybody off of oxalates. It's really a matter of determining what works for them, not just lumping. You can't have any oxalates. Impossible. You'd have to stop eating. You especially have to stop eating some of the best foods in the world, similar to the lectins. You'll see arguments online with this. People are like, you know, just going at each other because these guys are saying you shouldn't eat this way. This guy, you should eat it. It's crazy making. Imagine how crazy making it is for your client. Try to do the best you can for them to help simplify and to help make it easy for them to figure out what they need.